91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. No major U.S. urban area is as exposed to rising sea levels as South Florida. The city of Miami Beach experiences regular flooding and saltwater intrusion, and the water rises at the rate of 1 inch per year. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. The amount of coastal real estate subject to rising water is astronomical, but inland areas face a dilemma, too. The average elevation in Miami-Dade and Broward is but 6 feet, and even less in Monroe. A maze of canals operated by the South Florida Water Management District keep former Everglades lands from flooding. But if sea level rises enough, there'll be nowhere to pump that water. We have experts on hand, and we'll be taking your calls. First, it's news. And it's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We focus today on our most precious resource, clean water, so essential to health and agriculture. And also, we discuss having too much salt water on hand.
South Florida is called ground zero for rising seawater. Our region is the lowest-lying coastal urban area in the United States and, of course, has billions of dollars worth of high-rise properties developed by the sea.
Saltwater intrusion, of course, is another factor of concern. With us now is University of Miami Professor Harold Hal Wanless. He chairs the university's Department of Geological Sciences. His master's thesis was documenting sedimentary environments and sea rise in Biscayne Bay over the past only 6,000 years. Welcome to you, Dr. Wanless.
It's nice
Welcome
to
back.
Be back. Thank
Welcome
you
back.
Very much.
Also in the studio is Dr. Jennifer Hirado, the director of Broward's Environmental Planning and Community Resilience Division, where she's the chief resilience officer. Welcome to you, Dr. Hirado.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Wanless, I'd just like to start with you for a minute. Last time you were here, we were discussing that Elizabeth Colbert article, Siege of Miami, right, that was in The New Yorker. And you cautioned the community that sea level rise was going to be greater and happen sooner than most have been predicting, much more than the standard predictions. Did your words from that show have any impact? Has anything changed in the last year that you know of? Any actions taken?
Well, it's amazing, first of all, in the talks I give, which are quite a few, when you're out on Barrier Islands, you give a talk and you're forecasting a minimum of 6.6 feet by the end of the century. And they say, we understand everything you're saying because we're already living it, because the flooding is becoming so frequent. And it's so different than what it was 10 or 15 years ago that people are starting to realize that this is happening, and it's happening faster than predictions. And, something like the Elizabeth Colbert's article, I think both helps make people aware, and it also brings out the deniers because they just can't understand how
you were called a fearmonger online.
Well, this Fabius Maximus rebuttal, it said that article was only fearmongering. Today's post examines a recent example of climate fearmongering. Not only is it misleading, but it shows how the propaganda makes it more difficult for us to clearly see the world and respond to its many dangers.
Yeah, it's amazing how many sea level experts there are that have no science training. I mean, you know, when your doctor tells you something about cancer, you don't write an article or go online and badmouth it. You know, the 98%+ of the climate scientists say this is totally happening. This is certainly, almost completely certainly, because of human-induced burning of greenhouse gases. And the sea level thing is happening, is accelerating. And, you know, I don't know, sometimes if people can only sit back and understand that global warming, 90%+ of the heat that from global warming, from the fossil fuels we've produced and the carbon dioxide capturing the sun's back radiation, 93% of that heat's transferred to the ocean. Global warming is really warming the ocean. And so that's not some little thing. Water has a huge heat capacity. Last time carbon dioxide levels were at this level of 406 parts per million, sea level was about 70 to 90 feet higher. I mean, those are simple realities, and that's where we're headed. And because we've warmed the ocean, we can't just pull the plug on this real fast. And
Jennifer Hirado, more about your job as resilience officer in Broward. What does that entail?
Well, within the organization, I'm responsible for coordinating climate mitigation and adaptation initiatives that focus on county operations, as well as our coordinated activities with the 31 cities in Broward County. And then we're also the lead agency for Broward County in representing our community in the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. And that is the four-county collaborative involving Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe counties to organize our resources and our efforts on shared climate mitigation and adaptation priorities. So in a practical sense, we're doing a lot to plan for sea level rise, including initiatives for shoreline protection, planning for infrastructure, water supply planning, resource management. We have aggressive energy initiatives, and working largely on risk reduction investments that will protect our community today and planning for the future, embedding resiliency standards in the way we plan in our community with the recognized influence that climate change and sea level rise will have on the quality of life and the conditions that we need to prepare for.
Is there a comparable position to yours in the other three counties?
Certainly. Miami-Dade County also has a chief resiliency officer. Miami Beach has a chief resiliency officer as well. The city of Miami, Palm Beach County, has a sustainability officer who shares many of the same responsibilities. And true, too, for Monroe County, I think increasingly agencies, whether they're government or they're private, are seeking to identify individuals within the organization that can take on those responsibilities and coordinate across the various teams.
I'm interested to know about you. You received your PhD from the University of Miami in Marine Biology and Fisheries, and your studies were in phytoplankton ecology. How did you get from that, you know, marine sciences, academia? What led you to work with the Broward County government?
Yeah, it's an interesting story, but I started my career with Broward County as the water resources manager, and this was at a time when Everglades restoration was really kicking off, and my background in understanding the relationship between urban water management practices and the impacts on the natural environment was very relevant, and our division played a lead role in Broward County's participation in Everglades restoration initiatives. Ultimately, I took on more responsibility as it related to planning for water supply and capital improvement planning. But the transition to climate change really came through my staffing of the county's Water Advisory Board. And this board of elected officials fully understood that climate change in our community is all about water. We've been planning for sea level rise and its impacts on water supply since the 1990s. That wasn't a surprise to us that we would need to account for that change. But we began to look more and more at the impacts of rising seas on flood control and water management infrastructure. And it was with that background then and the Water Advisory Board's recommendation to our commission that I ended up helping the organization launch our climate change initiatives, climate change task force, and basically how things have evolved since then.
Where does the South Florida Water Management District fit in with your resiliency project?
Well, the South Florida Water Management District is represented on the, what we call the staff steering committee for the compact, that four-county initiative. So they have been very engaged. They've undertaken for many years analyses of the limitations of their system as it relates to future operations with sea level rise. The issue, however, is that there hasn't been an organized plan. So it's one thing to recognize the deficiencies and to even quantify the deficiencies, but I think that the lack of participation today would be in an investment strategy so that we can appreciate long-term, if we're going to assume that we can maintain these same water levels for flood protection, what's the infrastructure and what's the operational mechanism that's going to be employed to do that so that all of the other planning can be built upon the coordinated treatment of this regional management system for which flood protection across the entire region is dependent.
I'd just like to ask both of you, steering clear, if possible, of all politics, is your work made more difficult, and are there new obstacles in the face of the current administration and their views on climate change and sea level rise?
And deregulation.
I would say that clearly in the realm of energy policy, we will be limited. We've been counting on national leadership with respect to energy policy to help influence things in our state. As it relates to infrastructure, we are hopeful that the administration's appreciation of the importance of investing in infrastructure, of jobs, public works projects, or big jobs creators, and making these investments today not only will help spur economic activity through that type of employment, but basically you're shoring up right. what is the core of your economies for decades. If we don't invest in that infrastructure today, we will have weakened economies and fewer opportunities long term. So it's a prudent investment, one that will deliver both short term and long term.
Dr. Wanless, your views on that?
Yeah, the thing is, we've been under a governor that's been in total denial of even using the words sea level rise and climate change for a number of years. We have our younger senator that unlearned the reality of climate change. And what we've seen is
you're talking about Marco Rubio.
Marco Rubio. He used to understand it. And but we've had, it's our local mayors and sort of the ground floor of our political system that has really gotten involved in the last year. And even our congresspeople. There was a bill introduced into Congress a couple weeks ago by 34 congresspeople, 17 Republicans and 17 Democrats. And the 17 Republicans were mostly from south of Orlando. So that was... These are the steps we're doing, and it's turning out to be more from the ground up. And I hope President Trump gets on board.
But. You were also saying something, though, about the deregulation and how that might actually be a good thing.
Well, I think many people, whether you're in business or research or many other things, we're over-regulated, I think. And I'm sure it was done with good intentions, but it's just killed the progress of many aspects of life, not just the small business and stuff. So I think there's some good things going to happen, and I hope Trump, there's enough people around him that understand the reality of climate change and the economic value of moving on into wind and solar that I have hope that we're going to make some good progress.
We're speaking with Dr. Hal Wanless. He's chairman and professor in the Department of Geological Sciences in the College of Arts and Sciences at University of Miami, and Dr. Jennifer Hirado is a marine biologist. She's the chief climate resilience officer as well as the director of the Environmental Planning and Community Resilience Division of Broward County. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Dr. Jennifer Hirado of Broward County and also University of Miami Professor Harold Wanless of the University Department of Geological Sciences. Dr. Wanless, tell us how the king tides can kind of preview what will happen when you go to various areas in South Florida today and see what's happening to some of the areas, low-lying areas.
Yeah, it's interesting that if you look at normal high tides, they don't come anywhere near the top of the seawalls, most of the seawalls. And these king tides are as much as 2 feet or more higher than projected, and they're simply how the sun and the moon pull the water around, how their gravitational attraction pulls things. And occasionally there's a few other factors added on, like changing the speed of the Florida current or something. But this is especially in September, October, November, December, January now that we have these bigger tides at the end of the summer. And what you're really seeing during those is what sea level is going to look like at a foot or two higher. That'll be every day. And what we're seeing, we have these inconvenient tides that we're now having, as some people describe them. But that's just going to become more frequent. And it's
capable of drowning out cars.
Yeah. Well,
deep.
People over in Miami Beach, when I was over there with Elizabeth Colbert a couple years ago. The Public Works Department on Miami Beach was there, and they had a report that there was a broken water main, you know? And they said, this ain't no broken water main. This is the ocean. It's arrived, you know? And it was knee-deep water. And people don't get it. And they go shooting through with their Maseratis at 40 miles an hour, destroying everything that salt can attack underneath the car. And that happens. People just don't quite get it, that the ocean really does change and is changing and will continue to change. There is no stopping this in the short run. So.
With the Miami Beach building up of the streets and the pumps and all that, is that going to do any good?
Well, it's going to get them in serious debt if they can't pay off their bonds. And, you know, the problem I have with that is twofold. First of all, Mayor Levine says we're fixing this so people are going to be living here 1,000 years from now, just like today. That's not going to happen. Miami Beach is not going to make it through this century without being drowned out. The second thing is that lost my thought.
You were saying that if they can't pay for them, pay off the bonds.
Yeah, they haven't thought through a plan. You know, Jim Kaysen, the mayor of Coral Gables, has spent a lot of effort looking at every aspect of the infrastructure under each further 6 inches of sea level rise. And then you figure out what you have to do to maintain an integrated infrastructure. And then you look at what it costs. And before you do anything, you've figured out that certain sectors of your community at another 2 feet of sea level rise, you're not going to be able to maintain the infrastructure for them. You can't afford it. That's a very wise way to go. Levine did, when he became mayor, start using saltwater pumps. The previous mayor was going to use freshwater pumps, and that would have destroyed them instantly. They're looking too low.
Where do you pump the water, though?
Well, you pump it
in the ocean.
Well, that's what they asked me in 2009, the Public Works Department there. They had me out, and they said, we have water in our streets. Where should we put the water? Mm. Who cares? It's the ocean. It's arrived, you know? But now what they're doing is they're pumping it into the bay. Well, any floodwater, because of septic tanks and leaky sewage pipes and everything else, is polluted. And so what they're doing is pumping polluted water into the bay. And
what's the long-term effect of that going to be?
To seriously pollute the bay. You know, this is huge volumes of water they're trying to move off. I mean, it's pretty spectacular. If you go stand on top of one of those pumps on 20th Street and Alton Road, when it's flooding, you don't see the water. They have it hidden because they've raised the roads and they have all these things pulling the water in. But it sounds like you're on top of Niagara Falls. It's pretty impressive, but it's not going to last long.
It seems odd, but the west side of Miami Beach seems to be lower in sea level than the ocean side.
Well, yeah, that's true of most barrier islands. And partly it was an old mangrove flat that they just covered over with a dredged up mud from the bay.
So if I have live in a high-rise condo around West Avenue or something like that, what should I think? What should I do?
Enjoy it if you don't need the money. I had a lady from Monaco call up and say, I have two places on Miami Beach. I said, well, do you live there? Oh, yeah, I love one of them. I said, well, enjoy it. But the other one's probably not a good investment for the long run. This is true everywhere. This is not Miami Beach. You know, Naples on the west coast of Florida, a couple of years ago, they thought global warming was a Miami problem. And actually, you look at their maps at 6 feet of sea level rise, they're in worse shape than we are by far.
Really?
So, you know, this is all of us and all the barrier islands of the world and all the coastal deltas and all the low-lying marsh areas like you see along the coast. We're all in for this.
Dr. Hirado, you attended this Senate Commerce Committee yesterday, the hearing. Can you tell us what went on there and what came out of it?
Yeah, well, the hearing was organized by Senator Nelson and was attended by Congressman Deutsch and mayors of the city of West Palm Beach and Palm Beach County. And the testimony that was delivered, I think, emphasized a couple of critical points. One was the importance of utilizing science and continuing to support our federal agencies and their delivery of science that has value and necessity in helping it to not only inform climate change initiatives, but a whole host of other dramatic weather-related needs, such as hurricane preparedness and predictions and, you know, fishing conditions. And there's that type of meteorological and hydrologic data supports all kinds of needs within our community, as well as climate science. Also, the importance of energy policy, the importance of investing in risk reduction and the economics that are derived from that, and then the great need to be looking at infrastructure, and that we are inheriting a certain condition that's already in motion by virtue of the heating and warming that's already occurred, and we will continue to see this condition worsen, and we need to plan prudently for a future condition. But we also are in dramatic need of aggressive policy that can ideally constrain the magnitude of change that maybe we won't be able to enjoy in this generation, but certainly the coming generations are going to inherit a condition, and we need to determine how severe of a landscape do we want to leave them to navigate. So that energy policy and the deferral on aggressive mitigation is something that we feel very strongly we don't have as a luxury. But we have to organize investments in infrastructure short term, and the economics of the nation are vulnerable unless we build in risk reduction measures short term.
So
Dr. Wanless wanted to.
Yeah, Ben Kirkman at the University of Miami is a climate scientist, a very good one. And at a recent talk, he said, you know, the carbon dioxide you produce by driving to the grocery store will stay in the atmosphere for 4,000 years. Mm. That's what, you know, there are a whole series of things that once they sink in, it's like, oh, my God, did I really need to do that? And you know, so the sooner we get off this, the better. We've already baked in some serious sea level rise and some serious warming. If we stop today burning fossil fuels, we will still have the atmosphere warming for the next 30 years as it works toward an equilibrium, and that'll still be warming the ocean for centuries. So we've already baked in a serious problem, but Dr. Hrawal is right, is we have to get hold of this so we don't pass something even worse than what we're heading into now.
Locally, I suppose it wouldn't work to just build higher seawalls.
Well, yeah, even in New Orleans it won't work because you can only build them so high and they have to get more and more
massive.
And the
massive. Water can go under
it. Here anything. We're on this horrendously porous limestone, which helps get rid of our 12-inch rainfalls. They disappear if you're on the high ground here, but it'll come right up through, and there's really no practical way to offset that. And even the Barrier Islands are on a pretty porous sand. So, you know, the raising the seawalls, which Miami Beach is doing, and the pumps, they're all nice. And when when it's just the king tides and the occasional tides that pop up above ground level, they can sort of handle that. But once the water is just sitting there, once...
But you say those king tides are going to be more frequent anyway.
Yeah, and once, you know, mean tide level's right up there, it's a very porous sand they're on. It would either take massive pumping, which creates probably more greenhouse gases, that speeds up sea level rise.
We're about a little over a month and a half out of hurricane season. You just mentioned hurricane preparedness. Do you have any thoughts about this year's hurricane season yet? Or is it too early to...
I'm not a predictor of hurricanes. But what's important is that as sea level rises, that basically storm surges, which are not a high tide, they're this horrendous lateral surge of water across the land.
Right.
And everything, trying to take out everything in its way, they're going to become almost exponentially more damaging. And so when we're worried about, well, the inconvenience of high tides and the pollution from septic tanks flooding into the streets, it's really going to be the storm surges that are going to have us say enough is enough here. And so that's the problem.
We're speaking with Dr. Hal Wanless, Chairman and Professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at University of Miami, and Dr. Jennifer Hirado, and she's the Chief Climate Resilience Officer and the Director of the Environmental Planning and Community Resilience Division of Broward County. We'll take a break and come back and take your calls and emails.
And we return. 33 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman and today's Topical Currents. We continue our focus on water, South Florida style today, with University of Miami Professor Harold Wanless and also Dr. Jennifer Hirado, the Director of Broward's Environmental Planning and Community Resilience Division. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, please keep them short, radio@WLRN.org. Radio@WLRN.org.
Bruce writes, it's often said that South Florida's water is very good quality and relatively cheap on the monthly bill. If the county wants to get serious about conservation, why not raise the prices? Higher bills would encourage lower use. Of course, this would not be politically popular, but would serve to preserve this precious asset for the next generation. Do either of you have comment?
What's interesting is that both Broward County and Miami-Dade County are sort of the end of the line of the water flowing down in our unconfined aquifer. And we sort of use it and throw most of it away. I presume Broward still throws a fair bit away. Is that correct?
I think that I would draw some distinctions between the Miami-Dade and Broward situation. Broward County's cost of water is quite a bit higher than of Miami-Dade, and one of the major distinctions with Miami-Dade is that a lot of the area is still not on a sanitary sewer. And you can have incredible rate disparities. Some communities may pay $60 a month, and others may pay $200 a month. So there isn't equity in the rate structure, which is, you know, maybe one issue. But we've also been very aggressive on water conservation initiatives in Broward County.
That's
for sure.
Good.
And we are investing extensively in reclaimed water. Many of our municipalities do have reclaimed water systems. We just this last year launched funding for capital improvement projects to see that expanded. Are we doing enough? No, but we're going to require aggressive conservation and diversity in our water supplies because the Biscayne is indeed vulnerable.
And haven't some of the Hallandale Beach water wells having to be closed because of saltwater intrusion?
Both Hallandale Beach and Dania Beach have critically challenged well fields as a result of saltwater intrusion, but Hollywood's moved well fields west. Pompano Beach has had to move well fields west. Deerfield Beach. I mean, there are a number of communities who, independent of any additional withdrawals, will see their well fields occluded with salt water by virtue of sea level rise. Over a 50-year time frame, we expect we'll lose about 35 million gallons per day of existing capacity due to salt water intrusion. So we're going to have to address that and invest in new water sources, and moving well fields has to be part of our strategy.
Dr. Wanless.
Yeah, related to the Everglades restoration, we're looking for a source of extra water. If we would only clean and recycle our water, we throw away hundreds of millions of gallons a day of water in Miami-Dade County. And, you know, they're sort of under the gun by the state and stuff.
Isn't that to keep, subdivisions from flooding?
No, it's just we're trying to find more water for the Everglades, and we're trying to find storage areas and put in deep well injections of floodwaters up around Lake Okeechobee. There are all kinds of crazy ways we're trying to find extra water so we can have a better Everglades. Well, if we would only clean and reintroduce our water clean back in the Everglades, we have no problem, really. I mean, that's the amazing thing.
Why is that not being done?
The source controls on pollutants are difficult to address. The water quality treatment that's required in order to remove nutrients and chemicals that are found in the water so that it achieves the water quality necessary is not only expensive, new treatment technologies and a high energy demand. So when you think about moving and treating water, it's one of the most energy intensive activities in our region.
But it seems like it would be the wisest and most prudent.
Yeah, if you're in Atlanta or somewhere, they have to clean their water because somebody needs it downstream.
Right.
So, you know, we've had a cheap go with the water, and we could solve a lot of things, you know, because what we're doing with that water is we're partly treating it and we're putting it out offshore in 90 feet of water where it comes right back in. We're deep well injecting it, you know, hundreds of millions of gallons a day, and that's going to come back to bite us, too. So. Mm.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. We've got Robert. He's been on the line a long time. Thanks for your patience. Robert, Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hi. Back in 2014, I wrote a climate change book called Bursting the Atmosphere, What Happens When Rain Falls Up. And it concluded that before the end of the century, on our current path, we'll lose both our our atmosphere and our planetary water in a process similar to what happened on Mars. And lately, I've been looking at something called glacial rebound concerning Antarctica. The continent is depressed several thousand feet below where it should be because of the weight of all the ice on it. And as we melt it, the continent will come back up. Current earthquakes are measured when continents move in inches. We're looking at a continent that will start moving in feet. And I was wondering if you can comment on this glacial rebound effect and earthquakes.
Let me bring the glacial rebound effect up to North America, because 18,000 years ago, we had a huge ice sheet covering North America. And the weight of that pushed material from the mantle south. So the whole area from New York City down to Savannah bulged up. That ice melted 10,000 years ago. But as the material from the mantle is now moving back north under where the ice was, the area from Savannah to New York City is subsiding. It's called the collapse of the peripheral bulge. And that's the reason that North Carolina, Virginia, you hear about the Norfolk problems with the Navy base there and the flooding. That's because they have about a foot of subsidence a year, in addition to about the foot of sea level rise foot of subsidence per century combined with a foot of sea level rise per century we have now. So they're inundating twice as fast as we are right now. And up in Labrador, where we take our geology students in the summer, the land's still rising at a centimeter a year, over a meter, over 3 feet per century.
Much less technical, but Dr. Hirado, could you just give us a primer on our aquifer and how it works?
Sure. Well, the Biscayne Aquifer is principally recharged through groundwater seepage from the Everglades system. It's a critical source of recharge and preservation of water supply. We also have an extensive canal network that is almost directly connected with the groundwater aquifer. So as it rains and we move water through our canals, a lot of that water is directly recharging the Biscayne Aquifer as well. And we can actively move water from further reaches of the canal system into the urban areas, moving water near our well fields, and that helps to recharge the direct areas where we are withdrawing water. But we also carefully manage this system so that we keep fresh water where our coastal drinking water wells are and salt water away from our drinking water wells. So it's really important that we maintain enough fresh water in the inland area without compromising flooding to push back against salt water that wants to move inland. So we've basically maximized the flexibility of this system. We've already acknowledged we've been losing wells for years to saltwater intrusion. If we could mound more water today and do that without compromising flooding, we'd be doing that. But all of the drainage infrastructure, all of the flood protection, every design aspect of our community has taken into account what has been our historic hydrologic condition, groundwater elevation, surface water elevations. But as sea level is rising, salt water is moving inland, it is intercepting our well fields, and we don't have a lot of flexibility to try to counter that. We're also seeing the groundwater elevation rise, and that's limiting the effectiveness of drainage systems that were designed 40, 50 years ago that had a greater capacity.
There's nowhere for the water to go.
Yeah. Right. You've lost the storage in the system. So I just wanted to share that from my perspective, as we plan for additional sea level rise, there are a number of investments that are needed. One, do invest in the seawalls. Keep as much water out where water is just flowing without any barriers today into communities. That's an important investment. Use pumps where water is coming into communities to try to manage better. Design our drainage and our finished floor elevations for a future condition so that everything we build today is built to withstand tomorrow. But even with all that, as we progress 40, 50, 60, 70 years down the line, there will be areas where we know that the infrastructure improvements can't keep up. There could be storms, like Dr. Wanless has suggested, with surge, where we will lose infrastructure and we'll have to rethink whether we build. But I'm also very confident that we can, with the organization of resources, plan for and accommodate 2 to 3 feet of sea level rise, which is really the lifetime of a lot of the infrastructure and planning that we undertake in our communities.
Ned wants to know where he can find models or maps of storm surge penetration and impacts for Broward.
Well, storm surge projections with sea level rise have not been adequately mapped. The maps that I have seen have failed to take into account the salinity control structures on the canals, and that is an important feature when you look at the progression of the storm surge. There are storm surge maps, however, available on the website for our emergency management division. But those will need to be updated for sea level rise scenarios.
I'd like to add there's an FIU sea level rise toolbox online that you can use. If you just Google FIU sea level rise toolbox, you can put in your address or even just click on your area or on your house even, and it'll give you the exact sea level that where you are. Here at WLRN, we're at 10.43. In my community in Miami Lakes, it's 6 feet. The Fountain Blue Hotel is at 4.7, and over on West Avenue, Miami Beach, is 3.0. Mm.
Dr. Wallace, you were going to add something a little while ago. I don't know if you remember. It's when...
To sort of make it simple, it, with a porous limestone, if you can keep fresh water levels about a foot and a half above mean sea level, you can sort of not have too bad a saltwater intrusion. But as sea level rises, if you keep rising the water levels, you start to have flooding. And this is a problem. Mm. You know, so that's where we're headed. We either permit saltwater intrusion, losing our freshwater resources, or we start flooding out the communities. Realize that the mainland of South Florida, our high parts are near the coast, and then you slope into the Everglades. And so in Miami-Dade, the Sweetwater, Hialeah, and even the Miami International Airport areas are all part of the Everglades. So they're low. They are going to have flooding in the same way that Miami Beach is.
We're speaking with Dr. Hal Wanless, Chairman and Professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at U of M, University of Miami, and Dr. Jennifer Hirado is Chief Climate Resilience Officer and the Director of the Environmental Planning and Community Resilience Division of Broward County. Our last break, we'll come back. Take more of your calls and emails. Stay with us.
And we're back with today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and University of Miami Professor Harold Hal Wanless, and Dr. Jennifer Hirado, the Director of Broward's Environmental Planning and Community Resilience Division. Let's take another call. We're kind of short on time, so please be brief. Greg in Coral Gables.
Yes, thanks for having me, everybody. Dr. Hirado and Dr. Hal Wanless, thank you for all you're doing here. And I want to make a comment about something each of them said and then bring everybody in quickly up to date with some news from Capitol Hill. I'm the leader of Citizens Climate Lobby in Miami. You both know me. And Dr. Hirado said something very important, that we are in dire need of energy policy that will, well, for one thing, fund the crucial infrastructure improvements that most municipalities need but simply just don't have the tax base to afford. Let's face that. Also, we need policy, she said, to put us on the path to a low-carbon future. And there is one such policy, and I'm going to dovetail that with something Dr. Hal Wanless mentioned a few minutes ago. He talked about 34 members of Congress, 17 Republicans and 17 Democrats, who are finally coming together and working together to hammer out economically viable solutions to deal with the current and worsening climate crisis. And I've got some great news, Hal, that I learned yesterday while in the hearing with Dr. Hirado and our colleague Ben Kirkman. I learned that this Climate Solutions Caucus has grown to 36 members. So now it's up to 18 Republicans and 18 Democrats. And both of these situations come together with a solution that is surprisingly simple, but it is going to take a lot of people to raise their voices in order to make this come to fruition. And this goes to something that the White House mentioned a week ago today. Even the Trump White House just a week ago today briefly uttered the mention of putting a price on carbon. And this is something that all experts in this space know is the number one solution. This is something that could use the money that would come in from this could be used to pay for infrastructure improvements in certain areas, and it could also put us on a path to a low-carbon future.
Dr.
So Hal has been
very,
Yeah, Hal has been very supportive of this, and Hirado is, and Dr. Jennifer Hirado has been as well with Citizens Climate Lobby. So,
yep, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
You're right. This is one of the least painful ways to simply put a price on carbon. It's called a carbon fee. The money hopefully will go back to the people, and it's a very effective way. It doesn't assign blame, and it starts to get at the cost of using carbon fuels.
And next up, we've got Sam in Kendall. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I just wanted the good doctors are giving historical reference going back, obviously, thousands of years. In terms of local historical perspective, I grew up on the beach on the Venetian Causeway 50 years ago on Rivo Alto Island. And I knew then that when we went over to what is now Sunset Harbor, we called the Purdy Avenue Industrial Section, and it would be on underwater. I didn't know it was king tide, but certain times of years it would, of the year it would be. And some of the Venetian islands would be underwater. San Marco was the worst, and as you went further east, like Rivo Alto, it wasn't nearly as bad. And then you got over to the mainland, Jordan Marsh, or behind Jordan Marsh on Bay Shore Drive. It was always underwater at certain times of year. This is nothing new, or it was going on 50 years ago.
King tides have been going on forever. They're just working at a higher and higher level every year. We've had almost a foot of sea level rise in the last century in South Florida.
And we could tell it then. That's what I'm trying to say.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Sam, just to emphasize your point, Dr. Wallace, how long have you been talking about sea level rise and the need to pay attention to
it? I went to
it?
An EPA meeting in 1980, and I gave my first talk on accelerated sea level rise in 1981.
Yeah. So there we go.
And next up, we have George in Fort Lauderdale. We're short on time. George, hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. Regarding solutions, I don't think, you know, we don't want to reach that tipping point, and I don't think that, you know, reducing carbon, but would your two PhD guests please comment on the three following: putting putting reflectors out in space, that's going to reflect, you know, the rays back out. Secondly, sequestering carbon and from the environment, and thirdly, putting a reflective blanket on the poles to save that ice. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Wong?
Well, there are lots of geoengineering solutions. The problem is, as I started off this hour, we've warmed the oceans. And we're in for probably a 20 or 30-foot sea level rise just because we've warmed the oceans, even if we get hold of this and start pulling carbon out from the atmosphere. We should be pulling carbon dioxide out from the atmosphere, but we've already baked in a warmed ocean that's accelerating ice melt in Greenland and Antarctica. The others get risky. There you can also put sulfur. That also blocks the incoming solar radiation. And then we can have acid rain, too. There are all these geoengineering things.
Okay, we have some emailers. Ingrid wants to point out that on April 29th, there's a People's Climate March on Washington, and sister marches are being organized nationwide. The Broward March is at the George English Park in Fort Lauderdale, 2 to 6 p.m. Do either of you know anything about the People's Climate March? No. Okay. And another emailer. The city of Miami Beach, this is Seth, recently illegally removed all the remaining mangroves along Indian Creek between 23rd and 38th Street. Why has there been no public outcry about this? I don't know if you have the answer.
It sounds like it's starting. Mangroves... The county's been very good since the 80s of trying to replant mangroves and replant artificial reefs with sponges and things in northern Biscayne Bay, because both those things help clear the water beautifully, and that's an important part of a benthic community is clear water.
Can you tell us more about this Clio Institute, Dr. Wanless, the climate leadership engagement opportunities?
Well, about 7 or 8 years ago, I started a thing in February, a several Saturday event, training people so they could better understand all the aspects of climate change and sea level rise, so they could talk about it to their sphere of influence. And Carolyn Lewis was at the first one, and she refocused her Clio Institute onto one for training about simply about climate change and sea level rise. And she works It's a wonderful institute. It's trying to reach everywhere it can. It works in schools. They have training in different communities for the officials in communities, so they can understand what we know and what we don't know about climate change and where things are headed. You know, once somebody really understands this, they're not so denial about it, and they start to realize it's something we have to engage in and work on. It's the kind of things that Dr. Girardo was telling us. And so CLIO has been a very valuable mechanism in our South Florida community in communicating, helping others to learn so they can communicate with others about climate change.
Well, I just want to say that website is clioinstitute.org.
Very valuable.
And let's squeeze in another caller. Sam in Plantation, you're up. Hi.
Yeah, thank you. I don't believe that this is going to change until economically it changes. And I think the banks and the insurance companies are the ones who are going to shake up Washington and Tallahassee. No bank would ever give you a 30-year loan on a car because the car isn't going to be there in 30 years. When the banks start to realize that they shouldn't be giving out 30-year mortgages on property on parts of Miami Beach and Fort Lauderdale because the property won't be there in 30 years, at that point, I think you'll see people realizing that this is a critical situation. 2 years ago, they quadrupled in some places the flood insurance, and Rick Scott ran to Washington. How can you do this? There were people that had their flood insurance because right. they became actuarially sound. It went up from $1,000 to $10,000.
Right, and
all of a sudden, the business people got, all of a sudden, you got their attention for the first time.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And wouldn't it be wonderful if the governments were working together with the banks so that we knew when we were going to be heading to 15-year mortgages because suddenly your house isn't worth as much. And wouldn't it be wonderful if our governments were working with the insurance companies so that they would start to do a longer-range plan than a one-year insurance deal mm-hmm. that they can raise every year. So we have to do that, or we're going to blindside the people.
Well, the immediate solution is for people to start going to the shareholders' meetings at, for instance, Wells Fargo, and just say, stop making loans there because you're loaning money to people that live on the intercoastal for 30 years. It's not going to be there. You're not being loyal to the shareholders. The loyalty is you shouldn't make reckless loans. And if people started going to shareholder meetings for the insurance companies and particularly the banks, and all of a sudden the mortgages dried up in these areas, rich people who live in those areas would all of a sudden be, now we got your attention.
Okay, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
We have to be going.
Thank
thanks.
You.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Well, wish we had another hour. Dr. Girardo is a marine biologist. She's the Chief Climate Resilience Officer as well as the Director of the Environmental Planning and Community Resilience Division of Broward County. Thanks so much for your information today and your expertise.
Thank you so much for hosting the discussion.
Dr. Hal Wanless is chairman and professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Miami. He's also the author of books and numerous publications. Thank you, Dr. Wanless, for coming back.
It's a pleasure again. Thank you.
And that wraps up our program. It was produced by Polly Landis. Technical support from Michael Stock. Richard Ives is lead producer, and our online presence is directed by Jason Zabka.
Just want to wish everybody a happy Passover.
And it's easy to download free audio archives of each program at our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program is with author and philosopher Christopher Phillips, whose latest book is about the boundaries and relationships between children and adults. It's called The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Young. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.